Thanks for joining us today for our regular home improvement show on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller, and John Freiberger is back with us, registered home inspector, more than 50 years of experience. He specializes in energy design and restoring older homes, among other things. And I hope you'll join in. We're going to zero in a bit on siding, going to talk about choosing new siding for your home. And certainly if you have questions about your home's siding or, frankly, any other home improvement question you might have, you're welcome to join in, more than welcome. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And, John, I understand you've been getting a lot of calls and questions about siding. What have you been hearing?
I have, Larry, surprisingly. You know, it's all spring I was calls on wet basements, but evidently the basements are now dry and people are taking a look at their houses and going, can we still maintain this or is it time to reside? I'm residing my own place, Larry. It was built in 1861 and the siding is about shot.
But that's the original siding.
That is the original siding, and it is so old, it's boards. It's not bevel siding, it's boards, because they didn't have the saws to cut bevel siding back then.
Yeah,
I hate to see it go, but at some point, there's nothing left to paint.
Yeah. My home was built in 1906, and the siding, last time I had it painted a year ago, the guys did a little small amount of repair work on the siding and painted it. It's good as gold.
That's right. Your house has beautiful old growth wood on it. The sort of thing we can still get today, but the prices are ridiculous. So I've had a call from a couple fans of yours who listen a lot, and they call me and they said, you know, we want to age in place. We're in our mid-70s, and we're not so sure about the siding on our house. What are we going to do? Do we really want to put cedar on? Well, they don't know the price of that yet. But because we don't have this old growth wood anymore, and because cedar and other woods are so expensive, we have to take a look at the manufactured siding. And there's just a plethora of sidings out there. And it's really, really confusing because there are wood fiber sidings, there are cement fiber sidings. There's vinyl siding. When you get into vinyl siding, there's like eight different grades of vinyl siding.
Yeah.
Which are you going to use? So I thought we might have a program where people could ask some questions. We could discuss the merits of different siding and the issues that we are seeing with installation.
Yeah, installation. You've brought this up in the past. A lot of installers don't seem to know quite how to install some types of siding.
Yeah, let's get the refrain out early on this program, Larry. As I always say, if you're doing Hardy or LP SmartSide or something, download the instructions, print two copies, hand one to the installer because he's never seen it before, and show him that you've got the other one. You have a much better chance of getting it put in. I do a lot of training for home inspectors, and I have a program of PowerPoint called LP Siding and Thin Veneer Masonry. Assume it's wrong. Because unfortunately, that is our situation. We also have to be very careful, and this is not just siding, but windows and roofs, and especially windows. We have a lot of fly-by-nights out there. Well, and some of them aren't fly-by-nights. Some of them have been around for several years. But they basically are advertising heavily, and they're selling consumers garbage. And not only is the siding and the windows of poor quality, but they're installed wrong. And I'm getting lots of calls from aggrieved people who have paid. They always seem to pay more than they thought they were going to pay because they didn't read the fine print. So there's a lot of issues out there right now in home improvements with some of these heavily advertising firms who are not doing the sort of job that they should for the consumer. So the consumer has to be really careful. And that's the, I guess, the second reason for this program, Larry, is, you know, I get calls from people who need to sue the installer. And that's just heartbreaking after you've already spent a whole bunch of money and all the windows are leaking on you.
Yeah. Barry in Madison actually has a question relating to siding. So let's go there. Barry, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. We have a house that with metal siding was put on, I don't know, 25, 30 years ago, and it was painted once. And now that painting is scaling off. Mm-hmm. And it has to be painted again. What are your suggestions on preparation work that has to be done in order for it to, you know, to hold up?
Yeah. Well, it's unfortunately, I can't see it. So what I'm going to suggest that you do, Barry, is we do have a really good paint person here in Madison, Phil at Premier Paints. And I would take pictures of this and rub off a little bit of whatever is on there. Take it down to Phil, and he will look at it, and he will talk to you not only about prep, but also about the best paint to use. And people are making paints specifically for old steel and aluminum siding, where they have superior bonding to regular paints. So this is something I can't diagnose on the air, but at least I can send you to Phil, who will really help you out.
Phil at Premier Paint.
Phil at Premier Paint, just off of...
Look it up.
Premier Paint. I can't remember Phil's address, even the road he's on, even though I go there a lot.
Okay. There you go. You know, I had some aluminum siding painted on my home. This goes back to 1990.
Mm-hmm.
I drove by that house recently. And it's the same paint.
Yes.
It looks like when it was painted first.
It was probably the right paint and put on by a skilled craftsman. And there's no reason you can't get 25, 30, 35 years out of a paint job on metal siding.
It was great for me. When we talk about, you mentioned all the different types of siding, wood, vertical channel, tongue and groove. Manufactured types, steel, vinyl, wood fiber. What's the best? You know, and there's a price range for each one of those.
Oh, there certainly is.
So what should people be looking at?
It depends on what your needs are. But the first thing you have to look at, if you are going to, this is sort of a digression here, Larry.
Yeah.
I'm going to answer a question that you're going to ask later. If you're going to take the siding off your house, which is the best way to replace it,
okay,
you got to think about a few things. So you've got a 1929 house and the wood siding is falling off. Well, what do you got for insulation in those walls? What do you have for a weather-resistant barrier to keep out water and wind? So you need to think about some of those things as well, the preparation, because you're going to want to wrap all of your windows so that they're weathertight. You're going to be putting a lot of money into this new siding. So we want to reduce your energy costs, you know, reduce the maintenance of the house. So we need to think sort of systematically about the whole thing. And this is where we really need good installers, not the fly-by-night advertising on television sort of guys. What you choose may depend upon your house. My daughter bought a house here in Madison in a old neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Vinyl siding would not look good on the house she purchased, but the wood was shot. And she put on LP siding. And I made sure it was done correctly. It looks good. It looks like the original wood looked. I have a friend who's building a new house, and he is going to use vinyl siding because he does not want any maintenance ever. But he's going to use a higher grade of vinyl siding, not the low grade. Everything from junk vinyl siding to ultra premium, and there's a huge difference between them. I really like cemento siding as well. If I were in a neighborhood like the near east side of Madison where the houses sometimes are literally 3 feet apart,
yeah,
I would not want vinyl siding on that building because of fire issues.
Hmm.
Because vinyl burns. I mean, it's vinyl chloride. Basically, it's plastic.
Yeah.
And I have seen house fires where there's a fire in the garage and it didn't get into the house because of the firewall, but spread to the siding and burned the entire exterior of the house. So I think there's a whole lot of things we need to think about. What looks good? What is affordable? What is safe and maintainable? And you make your selections based upon those things.
Eileen in Lancaster has a question for you that may not relate to siding, but we'll take it anyway. Hi, Eileen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We have an 1890s Victorian, folk Victorian, old a couple of years ago, that all of the gables that have the cedar shingles on them, mm-hmm. that all of those shingles need to come down and be replaced.
Yes.
Now, how do you tell if that's legitimate advice or if it's bogus?
Well, if they're falling off, they need to be replaced. And they do get a lot of weather exposure up there. But the good thing is that all of those shingles are still available from various manufacturers. And to get some information on cedar siding and cedar shingles as well, both for roofs and for walls, go to the Cedar Shake and Shingle Bureau. Okay?
Cedar Shake
and Shingle Bureau. Exterior and Interior Wall Manual is what you want to download. And it's going to give you all kinds of information about grades, cuts, shapes, etc. Now, I have in my days redone many Victorian gables with cedar shingles. And one thing I do is I pre-finish them. That way, when I put them up, I know no one's going to have to touch them for 25 to 30 years. So again, you're going to want to make sure you have the correct paint for that. Pre-finish them, have a carpenter put them up, make sure they use the right kind of nails. And all those things can be found in the Cedar Bureau information. Does that help?
It does. You said the exterior and interior
wall manual. Mm-hmm. They have a big website. Just go to the website, wander around, and you will become a very educated consumer.
Yeah, sounds good. Eileen, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Robert in Wausau has something relating to siding. Let's go there. Hi, Robert.
Hey, I was just wondering. My mother's looking at putting new siding on her house. But she's looking at True Bricks siding, TRU-BRIX. It looks just like brick siding. It's made from real brick, but it's basically thin slats of brick that are snapped into place onto a specialized metal siding. And then there's mortar that runs around it, and by the time it's done, it looks like real brick siding. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if what your thoughts on real brick, like whole brick siding versus thin brick attached to the side of a house, mm-hmm. on various ways. What's your opinion on the subject?
I have not seen any long-term studies on the brick that is attached on basically a metal grid. You know, where basically you snap the 3/4-inch thick pieces of brick to the metal grid. I've never used it. I'm not very familiar with it. I have worked frequently with thin brick veneer, where you put a mesh on the wall, you put on a scratch coat of mortar, and then you glue the bricks to the wall and put mortar in between. If that is done correctly, which it almost never is, it is a nice system. If you want to take a look at that sort of system, there are a whole bunch of bureaus that deal with masonry veneer. The one that has the most educational materials and 53 beautiful drawings is the Masonry Veneer Manufacturers Association, MVMA, Masonry Veneer Manufacturers Association. Now, your brick is a manufactured product. It's not like a stone, because a stone veneer also, and then you go to the Natural Stone Institute, etc. But take a look at that. That may be an alternative. My concern with anything that's put on metal is, what is the condition of the metal? And masonry is always what we call a rain screen, just like vinyl siding. Water goes through it. People may tell you it doesn't, but water absolutely goes through it. And then it is supposed to drain down the weather-resistant barrier in the back of it. Well, we've got exposed metal back there. What happens after 20 years if we start getting rust? Is the brick going to start actually breaking apart due to rust jacking? So I would investigate the various types of masonry veneer. And again, if you do go with it, you know, download the manufacturer's installation instructions and make sure that everything works out well. Masonry veneer is not inexpensive, but if put on correctly, it lasts for a very long time. Real brick veneer, where you're using real bricks with a one-inch airspace behind it, and that can be retrofitted on a house because you can make a galvanized steel brick ledge to hold up the brick, but that will literally last a century or more. So there are a lot of different alternatives out there. If you need additional help, go ahead, shoot me an email at frei@chorus.net, and I'd be happy to email you things or discuss the alternatives in masonry.
All right. There we go. Thank you so much for that question. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller with John Freiberger. You're listening to WPR News. Taking a look at your home today with John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates of Fitchburg. John's a registered home inspector, and always great to have him talk with us. We've zeroed in a bit on siding, but taking other questions as well at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Kurt in Fitchburg called, couldn't stay with us. John, if you had aluminum siding, would you replace it?
No. I would replace it if there was a problem, like if your walls were leaking, yeah, because that means the weather-resistant barrier is bad. Aluminum siding, again, just like vinyl, there's lots and lots of grades of aluminum and lots of different thicknesses. And some of the thin stuff gets pretty banged up over the years, and sometimes that's becomes a little bit of an eyesore. But the better grades of aluminum will literally last for an unforeseeable length of time, and one can paint them with the correct paint. So I would never replace anything to replace something. I mean, just to replace it, unless it's really failing. I mean, we got to think of climate change.
Yeah,
I mean, all of this stuff, we smelt aluminum, we smelt steel, we burn oil, we use oil to make plastics for vinyl siding. All of these things are taking energy, and if we can preserve our houses with paint, repairs, patching in, whatever, that's what I really advise people to do.
Jim in Colfax emailed us, has an unusual situation in that he owns a 1920 wooden railroad caboose.
Aha.
The original car siding was replaced with plywood in the 60s.
Oh.
He replaced that with pine car siding about 20 years ago, and now that siding is water damaged.
Mm-hmm.
What would be a good replacement instead of using wood car siding that maintains kind of the same look?
Sure, yeah. He probably used just a regular plain old pine.
Mm.
And even if you pre-finish it really, really carefully, decay becomes an issue. So, again, I like cedar. There's cedar and then there's cedar. You know, there's new growth cedar, there's old growth cedar, there's something in between. But I would take a look again at the Cedar Shingle and Shake Bureau and see what is available. That caboose, even a lot of the old railway freight cars were a vertical tongue and groove, often blind nailed siding. And a cedar siding that is properly pre-finished and properly maintained and properly flashed, so if the water doesn't run down, it should last 50, 60, 70 years. So, again, cedar is going to be much more expensive than pine. But the last pine only lasted 20 years.
Yeah.
And if the cedar lasts 60, you can pay three times as much and still be ahead.
there
quality
you go.
Quality counts.
Quality counts. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Peggy in Madison will go to you now. Thank you for calling, Peggy.
Hello. I have vinyl siding, and it's kind of moldy like on the north side of the house, and I'm a little afraid of having it spray washed or just how to clean it, and then also not kill my perennials, you know, growing underneath.
Sure.
Yeah.
Peggy, how old is your house?
It was built in late 98.
In 98, okay. So the first thing that we need to find out about your house is whether it has a weather-resistant barrier. Now, your house being built in 98, you can actually, you know how the siding overlaps and there's sort of a slip joint there? So it can expand and contract? Okay, so you take a flashlight. You just take your fingernail and you pull that siding out so you can look in back. So shine the light in there and see if you see either a white or a gray fabric. If you find that, that's probably either Tyvek or Typar. That's a weather-resistant barrier, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that is what's keeping the water out of your house because your vinyl siding, as I said before, is a rain screen. It's like the screen on a screen door. It stops some of the rain, but not all of it. If you look at the bottom of vinyl siding, there's little holes. That's for water to drain out. But if you do have the weather-resistant barrier in back of that, there's no problem with having that professionally washed. And you want to do that in the spring before your perennials and things come up. Generally, what they're using is, you know, is a detergent. They're not using acid or anything. But you can talk to people in your neighborhood as far as who is a good house washer. But as long as we're protecting the interior of the walls from getting wet because we've got a weather-resistant barrier, then I would say go ahead and wash the siding. And Larry, one thing that we've really found lately, and I've seen a big change in the last 20 years with climate change again, and with the change in rain patterns, the amount of rain in Wisconsin, is I'm seeing so much more mold and green plant growth on siding and on roofs than I ever saw before.
Hmm.
Things have really changed, unfortunately. We are wetter, so we're getting more things growing on surfaces because that humidity is in the air. And, of course, the north side doesn't get the sunlight, stays wet longer, so it's a great place for growing mildew and whatever.
Peggy, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Monica in Brookfield, we'll go to you. Hi, Monica.
Hi. I'm calling about our 1970s-ish two-story cedar home, cedar siding. We're due for painting. I think the previous owners did staining regularly, kept it beautifully. We had it painted about 10 years ago. I'm pretty sure they use latex over the stain.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, we need to have some repairs and some painting. Is it necessary to scrape the paint and then repaint it with latex? What do we do next?
Oh, good question. There's so many different kinds of cedar siding. And most cedar siding was primed or painted with oil. And part of that is because cedar siding, the reason it doesn't rot, it's got acids in it. And if you put latex on raw cedar, you get these funny-looking brown stains because that's the tannic acids and other acids coming out of the cedar. So my guess is these people probably use an oil stain, and I would have stayed with an oil stain because there's always a question when you use latex on oil, is it going to stick? Or was it the cheap stuff from the big box? So that's always a problem. So this is something I can't diagnose on the air, Monica. So I think what you've got to do is you've got to call around Brookfield for people who have had their houses painted and find out who's the best painter and have he or she come and take a look at it. They can do different tests. They can do adhesion tests where they put some tape on the paint and they basically pull it off quick and see if the latex is going to pull right off. If that happens, then we've got some issues. If the latex is solid and is just simply aging a little bit, flaking just due to sunlight damage and things, it may be fine just to paint it. But we're into something where we really need a good painting professional to take a look at it for you. I'm sorry, that's about all I can help with.
Yeah, and if it's just flaking, what do you do, scrape it off a little and...
Yes. Now, it's a 1970s house, and 1970s houses worry me because some have vapor barriers and some don't.
Mm.
And so the problem is that every time we paint wood, we're adding a vapor retarder on the outside of the house. And we want the vapor retarder on the inside of the house because if this 1970s house has no vapor retarder and we've got three kids and two dogs and a cat and a lot of laundry, and a lot of vapor is moving through the walls. At some point, you put on that last layer of paint, which then peels off due to vapor pressure.
Hmm.
So this is why when people call me in Madison, I start on the basement to look at their siding, to try to figure out what's going on in that house humidity-wise and how it's put together. But a good painter is going to know those sorts of things if they've been in business for 20 or 30 years.
Monica, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Listener called, couldn't stay with us. They have new steel siding, and they have cement splatters on the steel.
Ooh.
How can they get it off?
I don't know. Cement is very difficult to remove. It's extremely difficult to remove. And it's new siding, so we really don't want to paint it, but we're probably going to end up having to somehow abrade that and then get a matching paint from the manufacturer. But there's just, I don't know of anything that isn't just highly, highly caustic and damaging that will melt cement. And it's a major problem in construction industry because they pour the cement and they scrape it off and it hits things and there it is stuck. So I'm sorry that happened to this caller.
Lee in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, hi there. Yeah, this is a question I have on a four-stall garage, 56 by 28 feet, 2x6 wall studs. I'm taking off all of the old sheeting. It had some crappy vinyl siding on.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of putting OSB, I don't like OSB. Would you suggest going to like half-inch plywood? I'll probably put that LP siding, you know, for a finish.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not big on OSB. And, you know, for the sheeting. I guess you call it sheeting.
Right.
And is it advantageous at all to use a 30-pound felt over a Tyvek?
Well, I share your hesitancy to rely upon OSB. The problem with OSB, it's like vinyl siding. There's OSB and there's OSB. There's bad vinyl siding and there's ultra deluxe vinyl siding. There are OSBs out there from good manufacturers, Boys Cascade, let's say, that are really good quality. You are going to pay a lot more for plywood. Plywood is more stable and it is stronger and is more water resistant. What I'm doing on my house right now, Lee, I think is what you'd approve of and what you're sort of planning, is I'm putting up Tyvek and I'm putting tar paper over the Tyvek before I put up the cedar siding. And I'm leaving an airspace in back as well, which is something you also may wish to think about. The idea of an airspace is basically, now this is on a garage, so this is probably not a heated garage, you don't have a lot of moisture, but if you were residing your house, and especially if it's an older house without a good vapor barrier, or even a new house with a bad vapor barrier, the idea of putting 3/8-inch plywood strips over the tar paper or Tyvek and then nailing to that is it gives you an airflow behind the siding. So if moisture comes in from the garage or from the house, you know, vapor pressure, it goes into that space. You screen the bottom so you don't get insects back there. You don't want 10 hornet's nests. And then I leave it open into the soffits. And this is sort of answering a question you haven't asked, Lee. But if we're going to spend a lot of money and put on LP siding or a cedar siding, I really think that this 3/8-inch air gap system makes a lot of sense. So that would be the what we call the belt and suspenders system. We have everything possible so that we don't get embarrassed by our pants falling down.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's see. We had Martha and Stevens Point. Not sure if you've covered fiber cement siding yet. If you haven't, can you please go over the pros and cons of this kind of siding as they're considering it for their new home?
Certainly. At this point, the only manufacturer that I know is the James Hardy Company with the Hardy Plank lap siding. CertainTeed made a siding called CertainTeed Weatherboards, and it failed. And they had major lawsuits, and they went, we're not going to work with this anymore. But Hardy has not had the problems that CertainTeed had. I like it because it's fire resistant. I like it because it's made out of concrete, and it's extremely stable. We don't have all of the expansion and contraction that we have with vinyl siding unless we paint it black or dark gray or something like that. So I think that it is a fine product and certainly has a good use. You need to go to the James Hardy company, and you need to download the Hardy Plank lap siding installation information, because most of the time when I see it, it's put on wrong. I want you to pay particular attention to the horizontal flashing, the Z flashing, and take a look at the clearances. So like when you put Hardy siding on above a roof, let's say a dormer on your house, vinyl siding, you only need a half inch of clearance. Hardy, you need an inch. So there's a difference between the different types that you use. When you have a gutter on your house, you have to end the gutter 1 inch from the Hardy siding. You can't run it dead tight. Because if Hardy siding does get wet, it will deteriorate. So the installation instructions are very, very important to have a good product. But I think it is a fine product, and if it's well installed, it is going to give you more or less a lifetime of service.
Jim in Boston, we'll go to you now. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Say, we're going to have a deck replaced here in the very near future, and currently you can walk from the house right out onto the deck, and we're talking about maybe putting an 8-inch step there down to the deck. And I'm just wondering, you know, we're physically okay right now, but you never know if we might need it to be handicap accessible.
Yeah.
So would I want to put the step there or just leave it basically the way it is and directly into the house?
Well, Larry and I were discussing aging in place in our houses just before we came on the air, Jim. And I don't know how old you are. I mean, your deck is going to last 25 to 30 years. So if you're 35, well, I think we're okay. If you're 65, I think I would probably not put the step in.
Yeah.
So, and the other thing, Jim, I want you to look at is you can go online to the Wisconsin Uniform Dwelling Code, which is the state code, right? Mm-hmm. They have what is called Appendix B. All Appendix B is how to build a deck. And it's very, very detailed. And again, I want you to download, print two copies, give one to your contractor, read it yourself. But it's going to give you everything so that your deck is code compliant and safe. Does that help?
Yes, it does. The other part of the question would be the deck's over where my dryer vents from the basement.
Ah.
And right now, I've got a 3-foot crawl space I can get in there and do anything with it under the deck.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess with that original question, I probably want to leave that the deck at the same height that is right now.
I would think so. Certainly there's always a condensation issue when you've got dryer vents under a deck, and the closer you are, the more problems that you have. I think that the manufacturer, the dryer, is probably going to say that you have to have a foot clear all the way around that. And so I would probably take out your manual for the dryer and double check that to make sure that if you have a problem, your warranty isn't voided by the venting.
Yeah, yeah, that's good advice. Jim, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Jenny in Wausau is wondering why a woodpecker would go after her 20-year-old vinyl siding. The apartment is located in a former commercial strawberry field.
A woodpecker on vinyl siding.
It's hard to imagine it's actually vinyl.
Well, it may be, Larry, but the question is this a regular occurrence or was this during breeding season?
Yeah.
Because a male woodpecker is going to pound to show how big and virile he is, and banging on your vinyl siding might really make a racket. So,
yeah.
But the other concern that we might have is that the woodpecker may be saying to Jenny, you got carpenter ants in this wall. Because a woodpecker is either there to make noise for mating or to find something to eat. So Jenny, do a little bit of checking. Again, as I told the lady earlier, you can pull that siding back and look behind it and make sure you don't have some problems going on.
Ron in Deerbrook, we'll go to you now. Hi, Ron.
Hello, I am calling about some
cedar siding that I have. It's been on the house for about 24 years. I'm going to restain it, and I would like to know whether I should pressure wash it beforehand, and if so, about how much PSI should I be using?
Hmm. Why would you be pressure washing it, Ron? Does it have a lot of non-green plant growth and things on it?
No, it does not. Somebody said you should always pressure wash your siding before putting a new coat of stain on.
Hmm.
I've done it in the past, and I haven't done that, and it seems to work fine.
Yeah, that's somebody who doesn't believe that wood warps when it gets wet. The problem, Ron, is I don't know whether the backside of your siding is sealed or not. If it isn't sealed and you pressure wash it and the water gets behind, it is going to go into the backside. The backside is going to get bigger than the front side, and all of a sudden all the siding in your house is going to be warped. So let's forget the pressure washing step and just do a little wire brush and sweeping prep instead.
Yeah.
Save you some money and maybe save the siding too. Make sense?
Yeah, that sounds good. I did seal the back when I put it up.
But oh, good. Good for you.
It seemed like that was a lot of extra work to pressure wash it first and then paint it.
I can see absolutely no reason for doing it because the problem is it wets it.
Yeah.
And so then everything has to dry.
Yeah. And that's could be a long wait.
Mm-hmm.
Ron, good luck. Thank you for calling. Joe in Altoona, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've had a dream of adding a greenhouse to my home ever since I was a little kid. And so I approached the city about trying to get permits, and they said that I need to find a draftsperson who can write up plans that'll sustain 100-mile-an-hour winds and things like that. I cannot find anyone who's able to help me out with this, and no one who knows any information about actually adding a greenhouse onto your dwelling that's connected.
Hmm.
Looking for advice.
Okay. Joe, there are quite a few reputable companies out there that will provide you with a pre-engineered manufactured greenhouse. So basically, you're going to have to put in the foundation and things, do some work on the attachment, put in doors, penetrations, whatever. Mm-hmm. But take a look. The best place to look is buy a gardening magazine, an expensive gardening magazine, the most expensive gardening magazine you can find at Barnes & Noble. And then look at the ads on the greenhouses in the back. And you're going to find somebody that will send you the engineering sheets for the city. Now, we don't have to be 100 miles an hour in Wisconsin. I think greenhouse only has to be 80 in Wisconsin. But you're going to find that the better quality greenhouses from the people that ship all over the country are well manufactured. They have professional engineer stamped plans that you can give the city to get a permit. And that is a lot easier than trying to hire somebody for $4,000 or $5,000 to draw this up for you. You're going to save a lot of money, even though you're going to buy an expensive product. But it's going to be a wash as far as the expertise. You're not going to have to pay an engineer here in Wisconsin to draw it for you. Does that help, Joe?
That's very helpful. I appreciate it. Thank you.
And you'll enjoy the magazine, too, and probably become a subscriber.
There you go, John. Thanks for calling. Oh, man. John Freiberger, our guest, registered home inspector with Freiberger and Associates. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're looking at home renovation and repair today with John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates. We've zeroed in a bit on siding, but taking other questions as well as we move along. You can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Tom in Superior has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Larry. I just like to make a comment about the difference between concrete and cement. Now, cement is the powdery stuff you use to make concrete. Concrete is the stuff you drive your cars on, walk on, and the planes land on. And a lot of people get the two mixed up, and there really is a big difference. If you poured cement, the wind would blow it away.
Okay. I thought about that myself, Tom. It came up once, and I thought, oh, yeah, we should have been talking concrete instead of cement. So thank you for that reminder. Randy in Trempolo, on to you. Hi, Randy.
Hi. So we moved a little farm building into our yard, our farm, to use for chicken coop. It was previously a chicken coop. Structure was good. It just, the siding was bad. So we had somebody replace the siding and the windows. It's kind of a arched building with really short sidewalls. Most of the sidewalls are the roof and, you know, the more siding in the front and the back. But it shortly after, you know, we painted it and fixed it up, and, you know, I sent some pictures in. I don't know if you were able to see those, but it, you know, started, you know, rotting pretty quickly after we did the work. And, you know, the paint kind of bubbled up. And I'm just wondering, you know, if it had something to do with, you know, the chicken heat inside or if we did something wrong.
And, John, I believe Clara emailed you the photos. So they're in your email.
Okay.
So
I'll try to reach those.
Randy, I tell you what, we'll take a look when we have a little break at the top of the hour. John will be able to take a quick look then.
Sure. A couple of quick comments we can give. We talked about vapor pressure earlier, and of course we got chickens breathing inside a coop in moisture, and that causes problems. The other thing that when we take a look at LP SmartSide, James Hardy, anything, any kind of siding, ground clearance is really, really important. I've inspected new houses where the siding was buried underneath the landscaping. Mm. Well, you need 6 to 8 inches of clearance. So if this chicken coop siding is basically on the ground, it's soaking up moisture. So anytime we move a structure or build a structure, we've got to think about having clearances between the wood or the whatever siding, even vinyl siding, Larry, has to be 6 inches above grade, according to the Vinyl Siding Institute. So it's very important to make sure that we are above grade.
Randy, stay listening, and we'll get that photo up so John will be able to take a look at it. David in New Richmond, we'll go to you. Hi, David.
Hey, Larry. My question has to do with metal roofs. They're pretty popular, and I think the ventilation subject is where I'm leaning to. We had a couple replaced, and I'm certain the guy did not do it correctly with the layering. I think there's supposed to be an airspace between the metal and your next layer, and they just laid it directly onto the wood, and now we've got a major ventilation problem.
Yeah, it's going to depend upon the manufacturer. So you have to know what brand of roofing they put on. And there's such, it's just like vinyl siding again. There's metal roofing, and there's metal roofing. I mean, there's the stuff you screw onto a barn through holes you drill in the roofing, and then there's a standing seam with all the hidden fasteners and everything. So it really depends upon who made the roofing and what they say as far as the installation. There are metal roofs that are applied directly over the tar paper or whatever. Is on the roof. And then there are others that really need ventilation. The type of building you have, the amount of vapor pressure you have, like I have a stable with 25 horses in it. And eventually, I'm going to put on a metal roof, and mine is going to be an extremely well-vented metal roof because I have to have it that way. But for a garage where there's no vapor pressure, it's different. A house is different again. So I think what you need to do is go to the manufacturer, see if it was done correctly. In Wisconsin, you have an implied warranty for correct installation that I believe is either 5 or 6 years. So even though the guy gave you a one-year warranty on the job, if there's a workmanship issue and it's just plain put on wrong, you can call him back and tell him it needs to be put on right, hand him a copy of the manufacturer's installation instruction, and say, this is what you should have read before you started the job.
All right. There you go, David. Good luck. Appreciate your call. But find out that manufacturer first thing. Ken and Marinette, your turn. Hi, Ken.
Hey, Larry. It's a pleasure being on your show. Here's the question that I have, is that I have a house that was built in the 30s, and up here there's logging industry pretty heavy in the Marinette area, and the house that I have has cedar shakes under a asphalt, which is falling apart, covering on top of the cedar shakes. And I'd love to take off that asphalt and, you know, whatever I have to do to the cedar shakes, or just leave them what they look like.
So, Ken, are you saying that there was asphalt put over the asphalt roofing put over the top of the cedar shakes?
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Because when you put on real cedar shakes, hand splits, you actually put layers of tar paper between each layer of cedar. It's very interesting. Again, this is something you have to go to the Cedar Bureau to take a look at. I'm a little concerned that you're going to find that the cedar shakes are in pretty poor condition. Generally, good quality, you know, dense Western red cedar shakes will last 30 to 35 years. But because you had the asphalt over it, we probably had a lot of moisture affecting the cedar. So if you take off that roof, you probably need to be thinking about, you may be faced with an entire roof replacement. And certainly a cedar shingle or cedar shake roof is a very nice roof, but it is not cheap.
Yeah, and not cheap at all.
Yeah.
there you go, Ken. Appreciate the call. Let's see. Terry emailed us replacing an asphalt shingle roof on a 92-year-old log cabin with a metal roof. The asphalt roof had two lightning rods on it, and they think they should put the lightning rods on the metal roof. The cabin doesn't have any electrical, and the only plumbing fixture is a hand pump for water. Two questions. Should they put up the lightning rods? And does someone in Wisconsin know anything about installing them correctly?
Okay, we're going to have to go to the internet for that one. I have lightning rods in all my buildings because I'm out on the prairie, and I think they're absolutely great. But I've got them on shingle and asphalt roofs, so I don't have that question of grounding. There are also metal roofs out there where now they are grounding the metal roofs.
Oh.
Yes. A lightning rod may still be helpful because then if a roof is struck by lightning, it's grounded, but you have a hole in the roof due to the lightning. So I think, Carrie, you're going to have to go to the American Lightning Rod Association. I'm just making up a name here, obviously. But there is somebody out there or a manufacturer of lightning rods that you can go to, and they are going to tell you whether you have to put, you know, non-conductive gaskets between and I simply don't know.
Would grounding, could she check to see if the metal roof would be grounded?
My guess is it isn't grounded because usually when I see metal roofs that are grounded, they're large roofs or they're very expensive roofs, like the standing seam hidden fastener sort of roofs. So I think some internet investigation is going to be required, but there are several different places that you can go and look up information on lightning rods.
Mike in Hudson has got Masonite siding on his house, and he likes it, but it doesn't seem to be available anymore. What's a good substitute, or where might he find more Masonite siding?
Oh, that's a good question. And the question is, what does he mean by Masonite siding? Because there's the old asbestos cement siding, which is a mixture of asbestos fiber and cement and water and particulates. The Masonite, if I'm remembering, was actually a cellulose fiber. Oh, dear. I'm afraid I can't really answer that one for Mike. It's one of these things that I think you can take a picture and go to your local lumber yard and say, I need to match this. And they may look at it and say, you know, hardy panel is a little bit thinner, but it'll probably look okay. But there's something out there that I think that will work with Masonite. Most Masonite has deteriorated over the years.
John Freiberger, our guest, be with us right up till 12:30 today, when at 12:30 we'll look at solar electrical systems. Right now, we have a look at the news. I'm Larry Mueller.
Thanks for joining us today on WPR News, taking a look at your home today with John Freiberger, Wisconsin Registered Home Inspector, and his firm, Freiberger & Associates, is based in Fitchburg. And by way of full disclosure, we should mention that Freiberger Consulting is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors. So do you need some help with a home improvement project? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Want to go back to Randy for just a minute, John. You had a chance to look at the pictures of the painting and the siding on that chicken coop.
Yeah, this looks like very inexpensive pine boxcar siding. And the problem that Randy has is we've got little short pieces. They look like they're 6 or 8 inches. So we've got little bits of siding in between vertical pieces, and it was never caulked. So what happened is as the water ran down the walls, it basically capillary action, it moved into the joint, and then it moved into the siding. And basically it caused decay. And we have to be very careful when we're doing siding, unless it's got that 3/4 inch airspace in back. We've got to seal all of the little fine cracks so that water doesn't get in there. Because we've got to remember that, you know, some trees are 400 feet high. They're getting water up there through capillary action. So if our chicken coop is offering capillary action, it's going to get wet. So I'm afraid Randy's coop is, at least the siding, is beyond repair. And we're going to have to get some new wood or hardy or something, some other siding to fix that up.
Sue in Janesville has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Sue.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I had a fan installed in my kitchen, and it's not vented for smoke. It's not vented outside.
Mm-hmm. So, Sue, this is over, like, your kitchen range or in the kitchen ceiling?
It's in the kitchen ceiling.
Yeah, so that has to be vented outside, either a through-the-wall vent or a through-the-roof vent. Because what's happening is, you know, as you're boiling eggs for egg salad, you're creating water vapor, and then you're pumping that water vapor into your attic. And what's going to happen, it's going to condense up there, and it's going to damage your attic. So whoever installed that for you should get called back, and they need to get a roof vent up there. Now, the other thing, Sue, is where it goes through the attic, it has to be insulated. Because otherwise what's going to happen is in the winter your cold attic is going to have this warm, damp air going up through this cold vent. It's going to condense and run down and cause corrosion and other issues. So if you know who made the vent, go to the manufacturer, get the installation instructions, print 2 copies, hand 1 copy to the guy who did it, and say, now come back and do it right.
Yeah, and he will have to do it because it was an installation problem.
That's an installation error. So there's no warranty now on the equipment itself. If there's condensation coming back, that can ruin the motor or cause it to short out. So we have to be sure when we purchase something that we get it installed in the correct manner.
Yeah.
And, you know, with today's internet, Larry, it takes seconds to get manufacturer's installation instructions as long as we know the make and model.
Sue, good luck. Take a look at the make and model, and I hope you have good luck with getting it installed properly. Nancy in Bailey's Harbor, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Yeah, hi. I have a question about a log home. I live in a house that was built around 1860, and I replaced a lot of the cedar shakes on the house. I know that it's a log home underneath because of the interior, but part of the back, I want to remove the shakes and have the exposed log. Mm-hmm. Is that possible? Is it safe to do that for the log itself?
Yes, it is, though logs, like any other wood, need to be protected by a finish. And you'll find that there's a bunch of log journals out there that tell you the products to use to preserve your log homes. The big problem that I see with log homes is clearance to the soil, is we've got to make sure that those logs are 8 inches above grade and are well protected so they don't take in moisture. So do a little bit of research. You'll find more stuff than you care to read about preserving log homes online. There used to be the Canadian Log Home Council. I think it's now called the International Log Home Council. But check your check the World Wide Web for Log Home Council. They published an entire manual, the Canadians did, which I now I think is international. But I've referred to that in the past, and I've got an old copy of it. But it is full of information. So do a little bit of research, and I'm really quite sure you're going to be able to expose those logs.
Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Tom in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I've got a 50s ranch house that has steel siding. It's got the kind of wood grain look to it,
mm-hmm.
And it's pretty faded. I was curious about painting it,
mm-hmm.
and how well would it stand up? I would hate to paint it and have it start peeling off in five years.
Sure. Now, as we mentioned earlier, they make specific paints that are intended to use to recoat metal sidings. So you need to talk to a high-quality paint store. This is not something you buy at the big box. You go to a paint specialist, take a picture of what you've got, rub on it, see how much powder comes off on your hands, because that is going to give you some information about how you prep this. But you need to talk to, I don't know a good paint guy over in Waukesha, unfortunately, I'm sure there's a shop there that does nothing but sell paint, and they've got some professionals in there who really know what they're doing. But there's no reason why you can't paint that and have that paint last for 25 to, it could last 50 years if you really do it right. But you're going to be using a more expensive paint, a specialized enamel that is meant to coat, and your prep has to be correct. You have to get this sort of white powder. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but, paint over the years does chemically deteriorate, and so the prep is going to be very important.
Good luck, Tom. Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Peter in Stevens Point, it's your turn. Hi, Peter.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Okay. I was an insulation contractor for 25 years up in Stevens Point. I think they're really below what their rates should be. We've gotten letters 2 years in a row now from the utility company saying that I have got the best rate per square foot of heat loss.
Mm-hmm.
I know when I was in business, they were saying an R38. I went a bit R55 to 60,
mm-hmm.
and my furnace often doesn't even kick in.
Yeah, that's I guess what Peter's saying here, it's worth it to put extra insulation into your home.
Yes, that's right. And I think very early in the program we noted, and it's worth repeating, Larry, that if you're going to remove your siding and replace it, you want to have an idea of what is in your walls. And there are a lot of different options out there that Peter's probably used over the years as far as filling wall cavities, and some of them are not good options. Because if your house is a 1930s or a 1950s, it has no vapor barrier, and you put cellulose in the walls, we could end up a condensation in the walls. A lot of the foams that I'm seeing going into walls are open-cell foams, so humidity is moving through them. So we have to really think carefully about how we're going to retrofit our walls. Attics are easy. And the other thing that I'm sure Peter did during his years was before he added insulation, he air sealed.
Yeah.
Because if we've got a 1930s, 40s, 50s house, we've got air leaks into that attic like mad. And if we put in R50 insulation and the air is moving right through the insulation, it isn't doing much good. So we need to really think long and hard about air sealing and vapor control when we're adding insulation to make our houses more efficient. But as Peter mentioned, it is well worth doing. You're going to be saving a lot of money, and you're going to be reducing the use of hydrocarbons to heat your home.
Vern in Boyd, Wisconsin, called about the person with the concrete and the siding on their siding. Magnesium chloride will dissolve it.
All right, magnesium chloride.
That's the Vern
suggestion.
Thank
you, Vern.
That's Vern's suggestion. Jeff in Superior, we're going to you now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. Beautiful day here in northern Wisconsin. And I'm learning a lot listening to this conversation about home improvement. And I know someone who recently gutted a home that had been sitting for many years. So there was mildew and some rot, you know, of the wood. And he's been putting ozone into the main cavity of the house and letting that circulate throughout the building because it reduces the mildew and the fungus and things like that. How long do you think that should be exposed, or should ozone continue to be introduced in that environment?
Mm. Well, we don't want to be in a house where we're breathing ozone. Mm-hmm. It is considered to be a pollutant. I'm not exactly sure what they're doing. If we have a situation where, let's say, the inside of the exterior wall sheathing is a bit on the moldy, a bit not great, we do a simple cleaning, a HEPA vacuuming, and then what I suggest is that we spray those walls with a closed cell foam. That then encapsulates everything. Then further on the interior, we're going to put up a plastic vapor barrier because the closed cell foam doesn't go over the studs, and we want that. So at that point, we've sealed everything. So I think I would pay attention to encapsulation rather than trying to do something with ozone. Because remember, as soon as the ozone is gone and the humidity is back, we're going to get more mildew. Yeah. So let's get it sealed so we don't have water vapor and so we simply don't develop the non-green plant growth at all.
Ed in Northern Illinois, we'll go to you now. Hi, Ed. Thank you for calling.
So this is a question about siding replacement and increased insulation on an early 70s ranch. Two sides are brick. The back and the north are shiplap cedar over Tyvek, over cornboard with R11 in the walls.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had people mention put blue board, just leave the siding on, put Tyvek and blue board over the top of it. Others have talked about tearing off and starting from scratch. Closed cell has come up. I need to seal down to the rim boards, but closed cell is pretty expensive on the outside for 100 linear feet by 8.
Yeah.
Yes. I really like the idea of putting closed cell foam on the exterior of houses if we're really stripping things off. Now, it can be a problem you're putting on the two gable ends and you've got the brick. So we've got to have some sort of way of, so it doesn't look funny with the rest of the place. We call this outsolation rather than insulation. And putting our insulation on the outside. If I were designing a new house for you, Ed, I wouldn't put any insulation in the interstitial spaces at all. I'd put all the insulation on the outside of the house because where we have the wood framing, we have thermal bridging. So we can foam these walls really well, and we are still going to have heat loss because it's coming through the studs. So I think that if you can do an inch and a half of isocyanurate with a R factor of 7.2 per inch, so that's basically you're basically doubling your insulation by putting an inch and a half on the exterior. I would certainly strip off the old wood because 1970s house, how good is the Tyvek? Was it correctly sealed at all of the penetrations? You know, is there a water spigot for the yard that has no flex tape around it? So I would strip it off, get back to the sheathing, put in your weather-resistant barrier, add some outsolation, and then go ahead and put on your new siding, whether it's going to be cedar or hardy or LP or whatever. Does that make sense, Ed?
It sounds great. Sounds like you've cut to the chase.
Okay.
There we go. Thanks, Ed, for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Diane and Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi, I have a 1950s story and a half house that's brick, and my soffit needs repair. I'm wondering if I should go ahead and have that repainted or if I should get a better material than wood on the soffit.
Okay, well, so do you have like a Cape Cod sort of house? This maybe has a couple of dormers on the second floor, so it's a partial second floor?
Yeah, it's a second floor, but there are no dormers.
No dormers. Okay, okay. One thing that I would think systematically about your house, and I think if we're going to replace soffits, the question we have is, do we want to vent these soffits? Because if it's a 1950s house, soffits are probably unvented. And that's one reason the paint is peeling off of them. I think I would actually invest the $500 this winter in an energy analysis of your house, where they're going to come in with thermal imaging, and they're going to show you, they're going to say, look, this picture around the windows. You got air coming in all the way around all of these windows. Here's an area where there's very weak insulation. Here's all these different problems. So if we're going to get into the soffits, let's look at the insulation first. And I'll tell you, these story and a half houses, you really have to think to improve the energy efficiency. But over the years, we've seen houses where we have cut the heating bills in half and the air conditioning bills in half with good insulation and good venting. So I think start there, because we need to know what type of soffit we're putting in. And it's probably going to be a vented soffit, but maybe it isn't, because the energy analysis may say to you, we're going to spray foam the underside of the roof, and we're going to have a closed soffit, and we're actually going to insulate the top of the soffit. Or maybe they're going to say, no, we can get chutes in and get continuous airflow. So this really needs to be analyzed by a professional, so whatever money you spend is well spent. Now, of course, you're going to be spending more money to insulate an air seal, but it is going to show up in your utility bills. And, of course, if you're in Madison, check with Focus on Energy and MG&E and see what you can get for rebates to really update this house.
Makes good sense. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Peter from Eden, Wisconsin, emailed us. A few years ago, they had their concrete entryway replaced, but before it set completely, a neighbor's dog took a couple of steps on it. The contractor was able to smooth that out, but they are left with a depression about 2 feet square directly in the walk path from their driveway. Oh, can they use, is there a leveling product? You know, they've seen them, wondering, can you get a leveling product that would prevent it from becoming too darn slippery?
Maybe. The problem is, it's probably a fairly thin depression. So there are epoxy-fortified levelers and things that you can use, but they could be slippery. They may look worse than the depression. I would have just left the dog prints.
Oh, man.
Sorry, Peter, not much. I can't give you much help with that.
Helen emailed. Her screen porch is 12 years old. The builders put siding along the foundation that touches the ground and is rotting away. In addition, it looks like the 4x4 posts are beginning to rot.
Oh, dear. Well, we talked about clearance multiple times, haven't we?
Mm-hmm.
The minimum 6 to 8 inches. Wisconsin Uniform Dwelling Code requires that any untreated wood be 6 inches above grade. So, unfortunately, it's been 12 years. So we can't call the builder back and say you did an unprofessional job. So I think what you're going to have to do is talk to another builder who actually knows something and decide what you're going to do, how much are you going to replace. If the columns are rotting and they're too close to grade and we can't change the grade, we've got to go to treated wood. And treated wood has its own problems, because it's pressure treated, has a lot of moisture, and as it dries, it tends to twist. So it's pretty complicated. So I don't know in what area you're in. We didn't get that from.
No, we didn't get that.
Yeah, but you need to find a really, a really good contractor. If you're in the Madison area, there's a bunch of companies that advertise here on Wisconsin Public Radio, and I can tell you from personal experience, those guys are all good. But I don't know where you're from.
Louise from Albany emailed us, has a 20-year
asphalt-covered metal roof that is streaked and is could use some cleaning. Asphalt-covered.
I'm not sure I'm not what picturing. We've got here. Yeah. Again, we talked earlier about climate change. We had the person called in about pressure washing their siding, and we said not to. We are indeed getting streaks and things on roofs. Depending upon the type of material, it may be cleanable. It may not be cleanable. One thing that I'm doing on my house, Larry, I'm replacing my very, very old cedar shingle roof, and I'm adding strips of galvanized metal every fifth course. Now, you remember the old farmhouses out in the country, and up on the top of the roof, they had this sort of fancy metalwork? It's all painted white now, but in the old days, that was galvanized.
Yeah.
And the idea was that the galvanizing gave off zinc and zinc oxide, and it stopped the streaking and rot of the roof. So sometimes what we can do on a roof that's got a lot of streaking is we can put a new ridge cap on that's got galvanizing in it, that has galvanized steel in it. And that will give off the zinc oxide and will help with the streaking on the roof. This is something you have to talk to a very competent roofer about.
Joe in Washburn emailed us here to kind of wind things up. What's your opinion of Brazilian LPE wood that's used today in decking processes? Joe says he knows it has a tremendous dead load because of its weight. Is this product an environmental disaster related to deforestation?
I don't know. I'm worried about any imported wood at this point. What I'm looking at for decking is solid PVC, something like AZEK. Again, it's PVC, so it's made out of oil. It isn't great, but it's something that's going to last a long, long time.
And on that note, John, I want to thank you so much. We talked to a lot of people today, as we always do. But great to have you with us, and we'll look forward to your next visit.
It has been great, wonderful questions today, and you only stumped me a couple of times.
John Freiberger, registered home inspector, his business, John Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg. Great to have him with us, and he'll be back and be with us again. Just a note for tomorrow on Garden Talk, we're going to hear how to use wool pellets to help grow your plants. I'm really looking forward to that conversation. And we're going to talk about apples, everything you need to know. That's tomorrow. Coming up, we're going to be talking about solar and solar installation on your home. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Well, solar electric systems are certainly one option if you're looking to save on bills or maybe reduce your carbon footprint, but there are some factors to consider before you invest. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us on WPR News. We're covering now what you need to know about using solar energy for your home. You know, it's the rare home renovation show where a focus on energy isn't mentioned once, at least once. We tell people to go to Focus on Energy, and here we're bringing Doug Detlaff with us right now, and he's a program consultant with Focus on Energy. Doug's been working on programs about existing homes and renewables since 2008, so he's got lots of experience. And solar panels, what we're talking about. And if you're looking to get them installed in your home or thinking about it, I hope you'll join in with your questions. Or maybe you already have it installed and have a question relating to what you've got. Number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Doug Detlaff, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining in today.
Well, thanks for having us. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, you know, before we get into the solar details, you say, I understand, that installing a solar electric system should not be on the top of the list when it comes to improving your home. And maybe you could talk more about that.
Yeah, solar electric or photovoltaic or PV, whatever you choose to call it. It is visible. It's exciting. It's something you can show off to friends and neighbors and relatives, but it's probably not the best choice for that initial, you know, initial energy savings. There's a lot of work that can be done on the home as far as insulation, air sealing work, heating and cooling equipment upgrades, even simple stuff, shower heads, faucets, aerators, water heater, things that are going to reduce your usage will actually help you with PV, because you're going to do two things. You're going to start saving on your bills right away. You're going to reduce your carbon footprint if that's interest to you. But also, as you're looking to size that solar array, if you can reduce your usage as much as possible, you're going to maximize the effectiveness of that array and have it do more and more of the actual consumption of your home.
That makes perfect sense, Doug. Excuse me. If as we look at the systems, there are, I guess there'd be different kinds of solar electric systems for people to use.
Yeah, so the main component, of course, is the panels. That's what everybody sees. And then there's a device that's going to convert that DC power produced by the panels generally to AC. That's called an inverter, and they may be micro-inverters located on the panels. It may be a single inverter located inside the home, or maybe on the structure for mounting the array. And that connects into your meter. And what happens for most people is they will use the electricity from the utility when the solar panel isn't producing at night, or maybe on a very dark day. It will use power from the panel whenever there's power being generated, and you sort of switch back and forth. If the panel's over-generating, in other words, producing more than you need, it puts it back on the grid for other people to use, and then the utility tracks all that power coming and going and trues up your bill either instantaneously or end of the year, end of quarter, depending on the utility.
Yeah.
The other thing you can do to sort of add more versatility to that solar array is add in batteries to store, so you're no longer paying back to the grid. Plus, that gives you some resilience during outages. But batteries and sizing that can add significantly to the cost of a system.
Yeah. Contractors, you know, there are some really good contractors out there, and there are some that I know there have been problems with. We've seen it in the news. Mm-hmm. How can Focus on Energy help with that, selecting a contractor?
Yeah, Focus Energy has a list of participating contractors in the program. They're versed in processing the paperwork, but, you know, it's really important to do some due diligence. I always recommend, you know, talk to friends and neighbors, especially if one of them has a system, the contractor they use, what they liked about the contractor, what they didn't like. It's important to get several quotes and really interview these contractors like you imagine it would be interviewing for a job. You want the contractor to, you know, note the age of the roof, condition of the roof, age of the home, what your current electrical use is, any future plans or additions, like if you're adding an electric charger for a vehicle, if you're moving from fossil fuel to a heat pump. They want to make sure to get the name of your current electric utility so they can look up that tie-in tariff for how the utility is going to track and charge for that energy that's going back and forth. You also really want to talk to them about what you're expecting to have done, what your expectations are for the system, what your schedule is like, when you expect the system to be done. And then they're going to look at the orientation and shading of the panels. You want to make sure that you're not pressured into signing a contract. If they're there and they say you have to do it right then, it's probably a good idea to leave, to walk away and go with someone else. Mm-hmm. You want to be comfortable with the contractor you're choosing. If you're interested in financing, you want to ask about financing. There are no money down systems available. But, you know, they're making up that no money down by adding it later on into the cost. So I don't know that there's really an advantage to that pricing of the system. But it is an option for a lot of homeowners to get into a system right away.
Yeah. Dan emailed us, is there a way to install solar panels on a sloped roof that doesn't require screwing through the roofing material?
You're always going to have to put something connecting the roof to hold those panels down. With a metal roof, you've got a standing seam that you connect to, but everything is going to be somehow attached to the roof, at least as far as I know.
Yeah, I can't think of any other way to do it. How much energy can residual or residential solar electric systems produce? I mean, assuming you've got a tight house to begin with, you've mm-hmm. done things right before you installed it, now it's up there, or you're thinking about how many panels to put up there, what can we expect?
Yeah, as a general guideline, the solar panels are measured in kW, which is current electricity. 1 kW, which is about 3 panels, 4 by 6 feet each, they produce about a tenth of the home's electric use in a year. So if you're looking for all of your production, you know, you're looking at a 10 to 12 kW system. Most of the ones we see are significantly less. They're a 6 or 7 kW system. And what that does is that gives you a good amount of production during the winter when maybe the solar resource isn't as great and isn't overproducing and having to sell back all that extra electricity in the summer. And you get that nice, nice blend of utility power for the reliability and solar power for the, you know, the carbon relief and the greening. Plus, it makes it probably the most cost-effective point.
Cal in Menominee, Michigan has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Cal. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I'm Cal from Menominee on the way to Milwaukee, and I have a solar system. I've been using it for about 4 years now. I don't have it attached to the roof. If you have enough room, they can depend on the orientation. I have the panels about 100 feet from my house, and that they're in my orchard. So I had enough space for that. And, of course, when you move it away from the house, there's more cost incurred because you have to have special heavy gauged, I think it's number 6 maybe, cables to transfer the energy to your system. And it's great. I'm off the grid, so I don't get the benefit of paying, you know, getting any of it back to the utilities. But in the summertime, I have a Generac backup that's automatically ecosystem that's set up that if it's cloudy or it rains for 2 days and I don't get enough energy, the generator will kick on automatically for a couple of hours and charge up those batteries. Now, in the wintertime, it's a little more. I only have 6 panels right now, but I'm in the process of getting 6 more later this month. But problems with the extra panels. So it's a great system. I mean, it's just like having a muffin grid. Like I said, it's like having a house with electricity. We leave our ceiling fans on. We have all the appliances that you normally have, washer, dryer, you name it. Solar's great. So that's all I had to say for you guys, unless you have a question for me.
Yeah, Cal, thank you for calling. Comment, Doug.
Yeah, the Cal's got a ground mount system, which is a great option for people with the room to install it, but maybe their house isn't orientated very well for production, or they've got a lot of tree, you know, tall trees that may create shading. And what it is you build a little structure, mount the panels to that. He's right, because of that DC power, you're looking at some pretty big cables that have to be run into the house. But again, there's some options around that too. The nice thing about a ground mount system too is if you want to expand, you aren't limited to your roof size. So like he's adding more panels on, you can do that pretty much easy once that structure's set up.
Yeah, that's really great. Cal, thanks a lot for calling. I really appreciate your call. And it sounds like you got a great system going there. Doug Detlaff, our guest today, program consultant with Focus on Energy, talking with him about solar today. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mailer here with my guest, Doug Detlaff, program consultant with Focus on Energy, talking with him about solar and maybe adding it to your home, or maybe you have an experience to share as well relating to solar. Katarina emailed us wondering if you have any information or an opinion regarding solar roofing tiles or other solar roofing.
Yeah, so the solar tiles or a solar media, so it could be a number of things, that was an innovation that came out a few years ago, and it had a really good potential to change the market. Not that it would produce more electricity than a panel, but because it was integrated into a roofing material, you had the ability to apply the solar panels and include them in the cost of the roof, which when you're installing solar, you got to take a good look at what the condition of your roof is. It's no point in putting panels on a roof that's going to have to be need to be replaced in the near future. The issue is that technology, while it's still there, hasn't come to the market like everybody had hoped. And it's only been recently that those panels have been available, or roofing material has been available. So I haven't heard a lot of feedback on how it's actually performing, how hard it was, and the costs on the systems.
Okay, so still hasn't taken big hold yet, so we don't really have the data that we'd like to have to take a look at that.
Yeah, but it's going to be exciting when it happens.
Yeah. Joni in northern Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Joni.
Yes, hi there. I just wanted to pass along a bit of personal experience that we've just been having with some solar. Our house in Iowa City, we just had solar panels installed on the roof, and we're not home because we're at our northern cabin, but we're seeing the production, which is pretty exciting. But here at our cabin, we're off the grid completely, and we did not want a whole electrified cabin, but we wanted just a couple of outlets to charge up laptops and run the vacuum. And so we got a portable solar array. It's not even an array. There are several companies out there. We used Jackery, and we have this wonderful little solar generator, they call it. It's a kind of the size of an ice chest, and it's on a rolling thing like a suitcase, and it comes with a couple of solar panels that you put in the yard and charge it up. And we've got about three outlets in it, and it's working great for us. It's just delightful. Yeah. So a lot less expensive than a big, fully electrified cabin. We didn't want that anyway. And so we're just really pretty excited about this new solar system in both places.
That's pretty cool, Joni. A comment, Doug?
Yeah, those are great systems for camping, RVing, or what you're doing there for limited amount of electrical generation. It's amazing what those you know, that small system can do for a home and a person.
Joni, thanks a lot for sharing that. I really appreciate it. I want to give Doug and Madison a chance to join in. Doug, hello.
Hey, Larry, how are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
I'm on, I live in Stoughton, so I'm on the bottom side of a hill where the hill is to my south. And I'm wondering if there are resources in a mature neighborhood, too. What resources are there to help me understand if I'm a good candidate for solar?
Okay. So I know there are resources out there that could help Doug. Doug in Madison. Doug Detlef, what do you think?
Yeah, so, a contractor is going to help you with something called the shading. There are some online tools. PV Watts is a website from Lawrence Berkeley National Labs that allows you to put in a home's location, put in an orientation, put the size of the panels, and see what kind of production you're going to get out of it. It also gives you an idea of, tree coverage and hills. I'm trying to think. I can't think of one specifically that does orientation like or topography like that, though.
And what was the name of that source, Doug?
PV Watts.
PV Watts?
Yep.
Okay.
PV W-A-T-T-S.
And on the focus on energy, you have some basic information as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, we talk a little bit about systems, what to look for, some nice links for finding contractors. We also talk about incentives available, both through focus on energy, if you're within a participating utility, and what most people are looking at is that federal tax credit, which can be 30% of the installed cost of the system.
Yeah, it's pretty attractive. Doug, yeah. Thank you. Dennis in Strum, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Hello. Oddly enough, I just flipped the switch for my solar power today.
Oh.
And I talked with about four or five contractors before I picked one, and all of them gave estimates. All of them had been able to look at shading things. Two of them actually came out to the property, and I'm now selling power to the electric company as of today.
Good for you, and you make good points. Talk to four. It's good to have, I think, Doug Detlef, good to have a person come out and actually look at your property rather than just doing it on the phone.
Yeah, I mean, they can pretty much tell production of a system online, but when someone's there and they're looking at the condition of the roof, they're looking at the age of the home, while those panels aren't heavy, they weigh something. They're going to add load to the roof. There's some wind loading from them. You want to make sure that, you're not going to damage the house by putting those panels on. You want to make sure that you're not going to have to remove the panels and re-roof in half the lifetime of the panels. So having someone come out and look is always great. Plus, I think you get a better idea of the quality of contractor when you see them in person and shake their hand.
Yeah, good points. Dennis, thank you very much. Glad to know you flipped the switch today. Billy in Watoka, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Billy.
Hi. I just wanted to call in because I joined a community solar garden quite a while ago, a couple of years ago. And so they feed me solar power, and I get a reduction in my regular electric bill from the utility. And when I asked the utility about it, I called them and talked to them, and they said, oh, we have nothing against doing that because that's going to help us reach our goals of, you know, reducing fossil fuel use and all that sort of stuff. So I just thought that people should know about community solar gardens. They aren't everywhere, but you can join one, and then you don't have to put panels on your roof or do any of that other stuff.
Yeah. Billy, thanks. Comment, Doug?
Yeah, utilities both offer an ability to buy in solar through or renewable energy through one of their resources. And if you're lucky like Billy and live near an organization or a government that has a solar garden to buy in, it makes it a nice, easy first step for solar, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Billy. Appreciate that. Janet in La Crosse. Hi.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. This is very interesting. I've had experience with solar electric and solar thermal. My home in Minneapolis, a two-story, three-bedroom, we put on panels for both solar electric and solar thermal. The electric was great. I also put batteries because I was caring for two senior citizens, so we never had to worry about not having electricity for their equipment for their health. The other comment, though, and so I'd say put solar electric on anybody's place where there's going to be seniors, that feel-good feeling. I had the batteries, so I had backup of knowing we were always safe was important. The solar thermal was awesome. It provided all the heat, hot water heat, for my kitchens and bathrooms. And I'm now in La Crosse, and I can't find anybody interested in pursuing solar thermal. And I'm interested to know where that's going in the future. And there's a lot of money going to universities or colleges for developing things. Let's go for the heat as well in hot water, solar thermal.
All right. Doug, what do you think?
Yeah, 15 years ago when I started, or whatever it is now, solar thermal was the way to go. It was the most cost-effective renewable energy you could do. And essentially what you're doing is you're running a fluid through a solar panel. It picks up heat from the sun, brings it down to a storage tank, and then you use that you use it to heat up water for domestic hot water or maybe space heating. What's happened in the last decade or so is the cost of solar electric has come down so much that all of those diehard solar thermal contractors have moved to electric because it's just more cost effective for the homeowners. But it is a great technology. There's, you know, like everything, there's some give and take to it.
But it can work.
Definitely. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Doug, here we are out of time already. Thank you so much. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but appreciate your time, Doug.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Doug Detlaff, program consultant with Focus on Energy. And by way of full disclosure, Focus on Energy is one of our WPR Mini Business sponsors. Thanks for joining in today. We've got a team effort here. Our producers, Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive director, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots more in store.